For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. Today, we're bringing you a special presentation of my conversation with author Marlon James. His novels include A Brief History of Seven Killings, which won the 2015 Man Booker Prize, and most recently Black Leopard, Red Wolf, which was a finalist for the 2019 National Book Award. The novel is the first in a planned epic fantasy trilogy set in an ancient, mythical Africa. A profile in The New Yorker called it a novel that counters the dominant impression of the genre it inhabits. Instead of kings with swords and flaxen-haired princesses, the novel contains pitch-skinned witches haloed in bees, and vampires that turn your blood into blue lightning, and demons that come screeching across rooftops in the dark. James is the first of this year's Hagen Center Speakers Series presented by Community Colleges of Spokane. The topic this year is Diversity Dialogues, conversations about race and equity. Marlon James will be hosting a live virtual event on Wednesday, January 20th at 5 p.m. Spokane Public Radio is the Speakers Series media partner, and Marlon James joins me now to talk about his work and the event with Spokane Community Colleges. Marlon James, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Sure, and thanks so much for having me.
So I want to first give a little bit of credit. I was first introduced to your work by one of Spokane's hometown literary heroes, who's Jess Walter, on his podcast, A Tiny Sense of Accomplishment with Sherman Alexie. So They interviewed you back in 2015 after your last novel came out. Yeah, and at the very end, I remember you just briefly mentioning that you were geeking out and drawing maps and like going into the fantasy realm. So for me, and I think a lot of people familiar with your earlier work, that felt like a surprise or a big shift. I wonder if it felt that way to you. Was this like new territory for you, or is it something you've always been interested in fantasy and myth?
I've always been interested in it. It didn't feel like that much of a jump for me, actually, for two reasons. One, there have always been sort of fantastical elements in the books I've written. Even Brief History, which is the closest I've come to writing a crime novel. But the most consistent narrator in that novel is a ghost.
Yeah.
So I've always been interested in that, and I've always been wowed by fantasy and magical realism and so on, and those elements. But I've also been very interested in African mythology. It's the analogy I keep giving is, If you're a rock and roll artist, sooner or later you're gonna have to come to terms with the blues.
Yeah.
And if I'm I'm writing for the most part about a black diaspora, sooner or later I'm gonna wonder where we came from and how that shaped us. And what I realized is that we didn't have, I certainly didn't have mythologies shaping us. I remember a couple of years ago when Michael B. Jordan said in Vanity Fair something about we don't have our mythologies and we're creating them, and there was such a backlash. And I'm like, but we don't, though. You know, we have folklore, which is great, but we don't. And I was giving a speech 2 years ago, at Oxford, the J.R.R. Tolkien lecture, which I was very honored to give. And one of the things I spoke about is, you know, when you live in a country that can take its mythologies for granted, you don't even realize how much it shapes you and shapes your character. And I was talking about King Arthur and Camelot and the whole idea of British civilization being caught up in that mythology without people even knowing it. But what does it mean when you grew up without that? And I realized that I never had those kind of foundational myths, that sort of different way of explaining ourselves. I like to think that mythology is kind of like the emotional history of a people. I mean, for most of us, it was history until somebody came and said, no, it's legend. Yeah. So so for me, it only made sense because in reading all these stories and doing all this research, the book kind of started to write itself. So for me, it doesn't feel like a jump because I was in that frame of mind already as a reader.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned that all the research and the book sort of writing itself. In the acknowledgments at the end of the book, you say that, you know, writers don't create great stories, they find them. So as I was reading this, I was curious, how much were you influenced by the research that you did into African mythology, and how much of it was found through, you know, other means of your imagination or other fiction that you've read? I guess I'm curious about the process of finding not only this story, but this entire world that is captured in this book.
It's after a while, it became such a blur between all of those that I couldn't, I don't think I could actually tell you how much of this was from the research, how much of this was invention. I knew that I wanted, you know, I wanted to populate the book with mythological beings and creatures and places that actually exist. Because it was still, a lot of this book was still me trying to recapture something that I thought I didn't have or I didn't grow up with. So so there is that. There, you know, the Eloko or Tokoloshe or so on, these are actual creatures in mythology. I didn't create them.
Yeah.
At the same time, when you're writing fantasy and you're surrounded by all these myths, eventually you're going to start spinning some of your own. And creating some of the territories of your own. The cool thing about, you know, a novel, being a novelist, is still invention. Brief History, the novel before this, is based on an actual event, and 90% of the characters actually did exist. It's still fiction.
Yeah.
You know, it's still me doing a suppose this happened.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And I think it was the same thing with this novel, that there is so much, it was just so rich and so overwhelming. You know, it's not even accurate to say I was, you know, looking at African mythologies. I didn't get to all of Africa. It's too big.
Yeah.
I think I was mostly in Western and Central Africa with a little bit of Ethiopia sprinkled in. So it was, you know, the just one blip in the continent could, you know, power basically three novels.
Yeah.
So it got to the point where for me, I couldn't tell what was invented, what was found, what was me trying to bring something that I haven't seen, certainly I haven't read before in the Western novels that I like, even the ones that are inspired by African mythology, even the ones that are magically real.
Yeah.
And when you're writing, I think page to page, sometimes, you know, things happen, creatures happen out of necessity. There's, I need somebody to block that gate. I need somebody to make this hero's progress really, really bad for a few hundred pages.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's what happens. You know, I characters sometimes arise out of our need for them. But a lot of it was me being a kind of a 14-year-old geek, really excited about these toys I got to play with, and just wanted to use them and be faithful to them. You know, if I'm gonna write a story about X-Men, I'm not gonna invent a character. I've been waiting all my life to write Aurora, so I'm gonna, you know, use them.
Yeah. I'm talking with Marlon James, author most recently of Black Leopard, Red Wolf. He's hosting a virtual event with Spokane Community College's Hagen Center for the Humanities on Wednesday, January 20th at 5 p.m. Two things come up for me. One is the structure of this novel is one thing that I really enjoyed, which is sort of nesting dolls of stories within stories. So the main narrative is told through the character Tracker, and he's telling the whole story sort of orally. But then there's multiple instances where he or another character explicitly asks for a story from someone else, and then we sort of get backstory or another layer of story.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite instances of that is Sadogo, the sort of melancholy giant with a past as an executioner. So I'm curious to maybe take him for an example of a specific character, and how do you imagine, you know, a whole world that's outside of that, and how do you balance that with sort of the forward momentum of the novel, the main sort of story arc?
That's a continuous struggle, and the version that appears is really just the first success after a stream of failures.
Sure.
When it comes to stuff like that. Because and then it's further complicated when you're dealing with fantasy, because fantasy is all about exposition. It's all about as reading who was it? Was it Kim Stanley Gardner? Maybe. And he's writing an article about how a lot of writers look at exposition as this unnecessary thing that stops story. And a lot of teachers teach, don't fill your stories with exposition. Except 100 Years of Solitude is all exposition. It's a tricky thing. And if I figured out the formula to hitting that mix, I'd have been writing, I'd have finished all my books already. Because it's hard. It's hard hitting that time of momentum. The other thing is, one of the things about Eastern storytelling, whether it's African or Indian, and one of the big influences on me was Vikram Chandra's Red Earth and Pouring Rain. Which is basically a story about somebody telling 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 a story.
Yeah.
And the thing about Eastern storytelling is that Eastern storytelling is not an act. Storytelling isn't an act of reduction. It's not an act of, let me tell you this one story about this one character. If you're going to sit down with a classic African storyteller, you understand you're going to hear 10 stories.
Yeah,
you know, not one. And chances are you're going to hear part of story 4, and he may never come back to it because we're onto story 6.
Yeah,
maybe 10 years from now he'll come back to that story from way back. And I know, and I wanted that because it made me realize something that surprised me, that I think we think because we're in the era of where we read, we're reading culture, we're literate, because we're in the era where literacy is taken for granted. I think we have a way of thinking that makes us more sophisticated, which is not true. Because if you look at the narratives that were meant to be listened to, that includes the Iliad and the Odyssey, by the way,
mm-hmm.
that and all drama, which your Greek drama, which you're supposed to listen to and watch, they put some demands on the ear that we would never put on the eye. You know, they will imagine if you're hearing 4 narratives at the same time and you're listening enough to follow. You don't have pages to flip back to. You know, you don't have a screen to shoot forward or scroll back. You have to listen, and you're listening to these polyphonous, contradictory, multiple narratives contradicting each other. Characters jumping in to take over the story because they want to talk about how bad it was that crop last season, even though we're talking about fairies in the bush. And you, as an I didn't like that illiterate, because illiterate seems like these people were disadvantaged in some way. Yeah. But you had to develop such a discerning ear, which I think in some ways, I'm always in awe of the ancient Greeks, because I actually do think they're more sophisticated than us. That, you know, or African, you know, people in the continent, the African and Asian continent, listen to oral stories because they had to have a certain sort of discernment. The other thing about it, and this is way, of course, is that the whole idea of truth is also an act of reduction for us. It's let's get to the core. Let's get to the truth. Let's stop giving me all these stories and tell me what's the true one. All this reduction. Whereas I think in a lot of these stories, and this is one of the things that came over into the Americas and certainly in Jamaica, truth is left up to you. You're going to have to decide who's telling the true story.
Well, it sounds like that's sort of the project of the next 2 books in this planned trilogy, is that we're going to get sort of similar elements or the same story, but told from a different perspective. And so... you probably can't give away who's telling those stories, but...
I mean, it's not a secret.
Okay.
Well, the second... It's not a secret. The third one is a secret. The second one is not a secret. It's the character of Sogalam, who in many ways is one of the villains of Black Leopard, Red Wolf.
Yeah.
She's telling the story.
Interesting.
I tell people, you know, you may have developed some attachments to certain characters, from the first book, you're really going to regret that.
Well, yeah. I mean, Sogolon certainly doesn't have a high opinion of Tracker, who's the perspective
Absolutely
we get. So
we and may he doesn't have rethink, a high opinion of her.
Yeah, we may rethink what we think about Tracker.
But Sogolon, even in Black Leopard, Red Wolf, is the only character in that whole mission, in that whole thing, with a sense of mission.
Yeah.
And you know, so she does have a different perspective. And, you know, it's not all my influences was African folklore. A huge influence on me is Rashomon, which is a film I love so much. I actually gave a talk about it a couple of years ago at a film festival. That the idea of the different characters telling the same story.
Yeah.
And how a story, you know, you and I walk into a room with somebody gobbling some Fritos. I'll think he's starving. You'll think he's a glutton. And we're both looking at the same evidence. So it's even that in itself is a very non-Western thing. In non-Western things, we have the final version, the director's cut. You know, this people said, even though people ask me, so whose version should I believe? I'm like, I'm leaving that totally open. The one thing you will never get from me at the end of this trilogy is whose story you should believe. You're going to have to decide or not.
Yeah. You're listening to a special presentation of a conversation with author Marlon James. James will be hosting a virtual event with Spokane Community Colleges as part of their Diversity Dialogues, Conversations about Race and Equity, on Wednesday, January 20th at 5 p.m. This is Spokane Public Radio. I'm Chris Messini. This is Spokane Public Radio. I'm talking with Marlon James, author most recently of Black Leopard, Red Wolf. You also brought up sort of the way that fiction is taught a little bit. And I know in addition to being a working novelist, you're also a professor of creative writing at McAllister and other places. So to me, your work feels so counter to this idea or stereotype of what might come out of an MFA program or an academic creative writing in terms of, you know, I cannot imagine bringing a chapter of this novel to a workshop and what would happen to it. What's your approach knowing that and knowing how counter your work is to that? What's your approach as a teacher in helping students find their stories and their voice?
It's hard. I remember one of my students, and I remember saying, congrats, it's been a while since a writer made me cry, and certainly not a student.
Wow.
And I said, but also bear in mind, no MFA program is going to take you.
Yeah.
And he struggled for a while, and he finally got in a few years later, and he got into a program. And funny enough, he got into the program and knew that would take him in because they had some changes, and I knew the people who are in it now. But I told him, he somehow managed to write the funniest and the saddest thing I've ever read. And I'm like, this straight up risking of sentimentality, even while you're playing with slapstick, is just, I can't think of a creative writing program that will think this is good, even though it's brilliant. So it's, I run into students who don't fit that mold. I do think creative writing programs have come a long way. Some are even taking sci-fi writers now, which was something that just, I've been teaching long enough to have to hold students' hands, telling them, I know, nobody wants your alien story at that MFA program. Just keep writing.
Yeah.
They have come a long way. There's still a lot of creative writing programs are still very workshoppy. You know, I mean, there was at one point I remember I was on a committee for a creative writing teacher, and they all sent in their samples. And after a while, I could just look at the sample and tell you which program they came from. even though we like to think nobody's doing formula, I think there is a certain, and this is not, and yeah, I come out of an MFA program. And I think they're important. And I very much defend them. And I think they've come a long way. But yeah, it certainly was a struggle for me because of some of the stuff I am interested in. You know, runs counter to what some people think is good writing, honestly.
Yeah.
But it's. I think, as I said, I think that a lot of these programs have gotten better, and I think a lot of them are being more open. Some of them even have black people now, you know. and I think, you know, maybe. But I will. Yeah, it was. It was. There was a time when I knew I had to like sit down a student and like, you know, you could turn into the kind of writer that gets into these programs, but you know that's not you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's but it was a struggle.
Well. Speaking about the lack of black people in academia and other important spaces, you're hosting an event with Spokane Community Colleges as part of their series, which is called Diversity Dialogues, Conversations About Race and Equity. And that's obviously a very broad and important topic. And I wonder, as a novelist and also maybe as someone who grew up outside the United States, what particular perspective do you hope to bring to that conversation?
You know, it's funny. Two years ago, I was at a festival because I wrote an essay called "Why I'm Done with Diversity Panels," and here I'm again. I don't know. I don't know if I'm bringing something necessarily unique as an outsider, because I actually think sometimes being an outsider made me ignorant to certain things. It took me a few months in America to come back and see racism in Jamaica, you know? And if you talk to a lot of us immigrants, we'll always say, no, you know, from our country, it's not about race, it's class. And I'm like, well, of course, because colonialism taught you that.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I mean, so many of my friends were part of the publishing paid me thing, and some of them I know very well, and it stunned me. You know, it stunned me that Jesmyn Ward was being paid what she was being paid, a double National Book Award winner, possibly one certainly in the runnings for finest living writer.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, I remember also, and this speaks to publishing, which I may speak to more than anything else. Years ago, when I made an offhand comment on Facebook about writers pandering to this idea of a white female writer, and the backlash was sudden and swift, and everybody ignored that 680 women of color liked the post. But we're still dealing with that, even after an expose 5 years ago about the whiteness of publishing. We still have another one that came out this year. People going, yeah, it's still white. It's still something. So I'm like, but we talked about this 5 years ago. And I think we publishing certainly has a long way to go. The other, you know, as just an actual black American, it's sad that 1 year after I became an American citizen, almost 1 year to the date, George Floyd was killed 7 blocks from my house. And I'm thinking, when I tell people that could have been me, they think I'm being dramatic. I'm like, no, he was killed on 38th Street. I'm like on 31st Street.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's more often than not, if you're brandishing a counterfeit bill, you probably don't know. I don't want to go too far ahead of this, but that there's a certain way in seeing America, I think, first as an immigrant, but then as a local person, as a local black person. And the perceptions are actually quite different.
Yeah.
You know, it's because I think on one hand, when I was just an immigrant, I didn't really think of myself as part of black America and part of their struggles. And sometimes I actually objected to some of the things black Americans would say. And a lot of immigrants did. It doesn't surprise me to see those international flags that were flying at that whole insurrection at the Capitol, that mob.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That part didn't surprise me at all. So it's complicated. And I think we have to talk about, you know, talk about race and talk about equity and talk about things on all sorts of levels if we're going to move forward. And I think we have this idea that literature doesn't play a role. And we have this idea that books don't make a difference. I know the funny thing is, enemies of literature never have to be convinced of literature's power. They don't need the lesson. They're going to burn the book. You know, when they come in, when the oppressors come, they burn the books first, or they stop knowledge, or, you know, it's, or they ban in libraries, or, I mean, people think the culture war is over. Librarians are fighting it every day, and elementary school teachers. It's enemies of literature fully knows full well literature's power. It's the friends of literature who know of a clue.
Yeah.
So those are hopefully some of the things that we talk about.
Well, yeah, and to bring that full circle back to your novel, there was an interview with NPR when this book first came out where you talked about the power of and the importance of Black mythology, and particularly in America, stories that don't originate with a slave narrative. And so I wonder, where do you see your novel and fantasy in general in the broader context of, you know, the story of Black America?
I think mythology and folklore is important even on the very, very basic level of giving kids something awesome to read.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about that. We could go into something super profound, but let's talk about something that makes a kid go, wow.
Yeah.
And how important that is, that something that sets fire to your imagination have characters that look like you. Because it gives you this sense of possibility. Now, I'm not saying kids should read my book because they would be traumatized.
Yeah, it's definitely not a children's book.
it's the book. For me, it would be the book children steal from their parents and read and end up being shocked, which I totally endorse. that's how I read Jackie Collins. but it cannot be understated, the whole idea of somebody young being entering this sort of world of wonder, and the world of wonder includes them.
Yeah.
And you know, in some ways, to me, you know, a novel like Children of Blood and Bone is doing even greater work than me, because it's YA, and the younger we go, and sort of, you know, it's literature has a role to play in people, particularly people of color, growing up with a sense of limitless possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that. I am so not cynical when it comes to literature. because I as I say, people against literature know its power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my guest has been Marlon James, author most recently of Black Leopard, Red Wolf. He'll be hosting a virtual event with Spokane Community College's Hagen Center for the Humanities on Wednesday, January 20th at 5 p.m. You can find more information about that event and this year's Hagen Speaker Series under the event tabs at our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org. Marlon James, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me.
Thanks for having me.